And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Of the mass migration of Europeans to the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century, Italians formed the single largest immigrant group. They settled in places like New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, and Chicago, and they brought with them political perspectives and, in some cases, radical sensibilities. Many of these Italian immigrants were drawn specifically to anarchism. They rejected electoral politics and indeed sought the abolition of the nation-state. And although Italians in the U.S. today are generally lumped together with other whites, in the early years, these immigrants were viewed as innately inferior and uncivilized. Jennifer Guglielmo has for many years studied Italian immigrant political cultures, with an emphasis on how they self-organized, what they believed, and how their militancy might inspire political activists and revolutionaries today. Guglielmo is particularly interested in working-class Italian immigrant women who were drawn to anarchism and to a feminism very different from what's called first-wave feminism. Guglielmo is an associate professor of history at Smith College, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. When Jennifer Guglielmo joined me from a studio on the Smith campus, I asked her about the social and economic status of the Italians who immigrated to the U.S.
So Italians who came to the United States, the mass migration occurs from 1870 through the 1920s. And it's a migration that is primarily from southern Italy, from the regions of Calabria and Campania, which is the region around Naples, as well as Sicily. And they migrate to the north. These are folks who are mostly peasants and artisans, and they are migrating to find work, primarily. And it's primarily a male migration.
Now, you said migration to the north, to northern Italy?
To North America, to the U.S. And so their migration, the other thing that keep in mind, I think that's really important about Italian migration, is that it is a labor migration. The vast majority are men, up to around 75%. And when women come, and they begin to come in the 20th century in larger numbers, the migration begins to move from one that is kind of highly circular. You know, there's the rates of return are very high for Italian immigrants to the U.S. Over half return back to Italy. So the migration is very much characterized in the beginning from the 1870s through the 19-teens, really, by men migrating in search of work for periods of anywhere from a year to a couple of years, or even up to some folks talk about going for 7, 8, 9 years. You know, they're working largely in construction or agriculture or manufacturing, and then they return back, send their wages home, and then return back to Italy and then migrate again. And women begin to migrate in the early 20th century, especially because there are jobs now for them too in manufacturing, in garment and textile industries primarily. So that begins their migration en masse. And it also encourages the community as a whole to begin to settle more fully, because you have women coming with children. And so the family kind of location moves from being a transnational family to being located in the United States.
So we can then say that most of these immigrants who did find jobs found kind of low-wage jobs?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority found low-wage jobs. Those were the only jobs that were really available to them. And these are folks who, you know, who had done apprenticeships and different kinds of work at home to prepare for the migration and to prepare for the labor market. But, you know, the kinds of jobs that they were being recruited for were the lowest paid, the most dangerous, the most stigmatized in some ways, right? These are folks who are building tunnels and bridges and skyscrapers and railroads. And these are the women who are, and men who are entering the garment industry at the lowest level of the trade or the textile industry. And then some are being recruited as skilled workers, but it's they're in the minority.
How were Italian immigrants to the U.S. generally looked upon?
They were typically, you know, the ideas about Southern Italians that formed throughout Europe in this period really traveled with them. You know, they were thought of as being racially inferior to other Europeans. They were seen as being kind of racially mixed because of the multiple histories of migrations and conquests in southern Italy. You know, southern Italy is a land of Arab, Norman, African, Greek, so many different influences. So there was this sense of this community of the southern Italians as being racially inferior, as being racially other, and as close to Africa. And there was a saying that Africa begins south of Rome. And so these ideas of racial inferiority were, of course, circulating around the globe at this time. In the late 19th century, you know, there's a race science emerging to justify kind of racial categorization and hierarchy that located some people at the bottom and some people at the top. And those ideologies gave shape to a range of practices that kept such groups enslaved, as in the case of Africans, or in the case of indigenous peoples, justified the expropriation of their lands and practices of genocide. And for Southern Italians, you know, in that historical context, what it meant for them was that they were seen as particularly suited to very grueling kinds of labor. They were seen as kind of innately inclined to being able to do very arduous physical tasks that, you know, men and women from the more well-respected races, right, of Northern Europe were not seen as, you know, capable of doing. And those ideologies, they also shaped not only a sense of their what they were capable of in terms of their labor, but they also created a sense of them as innately deviant in some ways, too. There was a Cesare Lombroso, who's an Italian criminologist in this period. His ideas became very popular in the 19th century. They circulated all throughout Europe and the U.S., and he did all these studies that were very popular in this period of measuring skulls and doing these kinds of biological analyses of people in order to create an argument for their racial inferiority. And he created, he wrote several books about kind of the inherent criminality and deviance of Southern Italians. So when Southern Italians came to North America, they were greeted by this whole host of ideologies that saw them, you know, as racially unfit, and the question about whether they could become American citizens and really assimilate into the United States was absolutely a question. You know, it wasn't something that was taken for granted. And many people thought that they were not racially suitable to become American. The difference, of course, between what happened to them and what happened to other folks who we now think of as people of color is that there were ultimately no real laws that emerged as a result of those ideologies that put those ideologies into kind of material form. You know, so there weren't systems of exclusion like there were with the Chinese, or systems of racial segregation that there were with Mexicans, with Native Americans, and with African Americans. You know, these ideologies absolutely impacted Italian and Italian Americans' ability to, you know, have class mobility for certain, and the way that they perceived themselves in the U.S. But in the end, their Europeanness won out, and an argument for their being included in American society won out as well as whites.
So in other words, as racially mixed, as viewed as racially mixed, whiteness was seen as part of that mixture. So in some sense, would you say, at least partly, would you say they were Italian immigrants were situated as whites?
I would, yes. I would say, you know, my brother Tom Guglielmo, he's written a book about this called White on Arrival. And his argument is that while there are these ideologies that constructed Italians as Southern Italians as racial inferior were quite powerful and quite popular, that in many ways, in the most significant of ways, they were categorized as whites on arrival. And his book, which won a number of really important awards and has been very well received, so I recommend it to everybody who's really interested in this question of race. Again, it's called White on Arrival. His book looks at, for example, naturalization law. You know, for many groups, the ability to become American was just not permitted, you know, especially for Chinese, for anybody who's deemed non-white, they were not allowed to become American. And so this affected Chinese, Japanese, South Asian, Korean, all Asian immigrants, and many other groups as well. But Italians were located as white, so they were permitted to naturalize and become U.S. citizens. And that's just one example of, and a powerful example, right? Because to become a citizen means you can then own property, you can vote, you imagine yourself as part of the community in a way that's very different from somebody who's not permitted to become a citizen.
Jennifer Guglielmo joins me. She teaches history at Smith College, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Italian immigrant women specifically, you write, were viewed as docile and as dominated by excessively patriarchal men. What explains this stereotype?
Yeah, I mean, that was really at the root of what I tried to get at, because that stereotype was, as I would discover, was shaping the ways in which historical memory was forming about Italian immigrant women and their descendants. That narrative, you know, when I started grad school, that was the dominant narrative in every history book, is that they weren't active. They did not have histories or traditions of resistance, and that unlike the Jewish women to whom they were most often compared because they migrated at the same time to the U.S. and they settled in the same neighborhoods and worked in many of the same jobs, that they were seen as more dominated, more kind of cloistered in their homes and less politically engaged. So I, of course, went in search of trying to understand the origins of that ideology and then, of course, the impact that that ideology had on this history. And I traced the origins of that ideology ultimately to southern Italy and to the kind of state-building project in Italy in the 19th century. So Italy forms as a nation in 1870, and part of that political project is about northern Italian provinces establishing their authority and control over the south. And one of the legitimizing discourses that they use to do that is to argue that southern Italians aren't capable of their own self-government, that they are in need of a more civilized, in quotes, regime to guide them into modernity. And that's a gendered ideology, and the way in which it gets applied to women is to imagine them as innately passive and as controlled by the men in their communities and as in need of a state to come in and direct them and educate them, and even if, you know, not informally, if, you know, informally. And those ideas about them, and it also justifies, right, their control on some level. You know, Northern Italy sent thousands of troops into the South in order to kind of quell the resistance that they met to this state-building project that ultimately was extracting resources from the South, and in the sense that it was taking land away from people and reappropriating it in different ways. And so people didn't have access to the kinds of resources they needed to survive. And so they were, as you can imagine, they were met with, you know, enormous resistance. People couldn't feed themselves. And, you know, they had wealthy landowners coming in. And the church, of course, was a big part of this, too, taking up big tracts of land and people unable to farm in the way they had been in previously. So there's a whole resistance movement that emerges out of the South in this time to the Italian nation state. And, you know, the state has to justify why it's sending in thousands of troops to quell this resistance. And it does so by saying that these folks are barbarous, that they're uncivilized, that they're in need of control, and that the women in particular are seen as really problematic. And what happens when Italian women begin to migrate to the United States is those ideologies, of course, kind of circulate and come with them. And so the ways in which elites in the U.S. imagine them is as in need of uplift, in need of civilization. And white women at the time were, you know, building an argument for their own inclusion in politics, in formal politics, and in the public sphere. And so part of the way they were building an argument to justify their, you know, to justify suffrage, to justify their activity in their communities, to justify their participation in formal political communities was by saying that they had a particularly kind of gendered role to play and that they could help assimilate the millions of Southern and Eastern Europeans that were pouring into the United States as well as other projects like to assimilate Native American peoples that were at that same time being put on reservations. And so that, you know, that it's in their interest ultimately, as they imagine it, to argue that these are women who need them to uplift them. And so we see that that idea of them as passive and as dominated really grows once they come to the United States.
Let's talk about how Italian immigrants organized themselves or helped their communities in the U.S. You write that the Mutual Aid Society became these immigrants' primary method of self-help and survival in the U.S. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the Mutual Aid Society, as a historian, is, to me, one of the most interesting manifestations in American history that is so confined to working class history. You don't really see people talking about the Mutual Aid Societies in dominant narratives of American history. And it's a real shame because they were absolutely fundamental to the ways in which working class folks, everyday folks, you know, who were, you know, working class folks were the vast majority of people in the United States. And I think one could still argue that they still are, although the notion of what constitutes the working class has changed. But at the beginning of the 20th century, working class people, you know, there wasn't a system of welfare or state agencies to assist people in any way. And so people had to provide those services for themselves as best they could. And the Mutual Aid Society emerged as a way for working class folks to pool their resources and to provide for themselves. So they provided things like death benefits and insurance and other kinds of forms of mutual aid and support, loans to help people start businesses. And they became kind of the absolute core of almost every working class community in the United States. And it's fascinating to study them, I think, whether it's for Mexican Americans or Chinese immigrants or African Americans or Italians and Jews, any group really, this is really the heart. Sometimes they're called benevolent aid societies. And so these folks pooled their resources, came together, and then these mutual aid societies went in multiple different directions. Some of them took on religious kind of and spiritual kind of purposes. Some of them became patriotic and nationalistic. And some of them became a place for folks to organize around issues of labor. And also not only labor organizations, but also self-help. Like some of these mutual aid societies, especially within the African American tradition, developed into banks and supermarkets and schools. So a great deal of institution building grew out of them for many communities. And for Italians, like for many other folks, they provided a way into the labor movement. It was the way that folks came together and shared what they were struggling with in their jobs and began to strategize about how to change and affect their working conditions. And then, of course, that led them to connect with other workers and to begin to read and think in larger terms about their struggles they were facing. So then they, you know, many of these mutual aid societies began to establish libraries and study groups and places for folks to educate themselves. They've founded newspapers to circulate their ideas. They were really at the heart. They're really at the heart of every working class community. And so to study Italian immigrant political cultures, the Mutual Aid Society is really the building block. It's really the heart of the political culture in this period.
Well, how active were women specifically in the Mutual Aid Societies? And I'm thinking specifically of more of the politically radical types of these societies.
Yeah, so the socialist and anarchist mutual aid societies became, you know, the most popular mutual aid societies among Italian immigrants. And the women they participated in them, I discovered, in ways that were very particular in the sense that it was a very gendered understanding of how you're the role that you played in these circles. The men, for the most part, were the ones who attended the meetings weekly. They were the ones who established the newspapers. They were the ones who built the bookstores. And so they were really the ones who were defining the culture in that way. And the women were participating in aspects of the Mutual Aid Society. They were particularly involved in the theater groups that emerged out of these societies, in forming theater groups and in not only performing locally, but touring also throughout their various regions, you know, the Northeast, they go from radical community to radical community and would perform. Women were very much a part of that. The women, of course, at the big festivals, you know, there were several festivals that these mutual aid societies would throw every year. The women were, of course, cooking all the food. They were, you know, helping to establish, you know, create the setting, you know, performing musically as well as poetry, things like that. But they weren't attending the meetings regularly, and they felt in many occasions very marginalized by the larger political culture and by their mutual aid society groups too. So some of them formed their own groups within, kind of female auxiliaries within these groups to create a space for women to come together. In Patterson and in New York City, women formed what was called an anarchist women's group, a Gruppo Femminile di Propaganda, in order to create a space for women because they felt like they were not being heard or taken seriously within this world.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jennifer Guglielmo joins me. She's an associate professor of history at Smith College. She presented a paper about Italian immigrant women's anarchist feminism in the U.S. at the recent North American Anarchist Studies Conference in San Francisco, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. That's published by University of North Carolina Press. We have a link to her faculty page at Smith, as well as to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So you have these women breaking off, you know, to some degree and forming their own groups. And I want to ask you about the kinds of things these particular radical women advocated for. And maybe we could start here because we hear a lot about feminism at this time. And, you know, often the portrait is middle class or upper class white women in the U.S. So did these particular Italian women, did they seek alliances with what might have been called mainstream feminism, or maybe that's a term we use now, but what is now called mainstream feminism back then?
Yeah, one of the things I do as a historian, as a professor of women's history, is to expand the notion of feminist activity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, because the kind of gravitational pull in the center of this history has been so defined by white middle class women's histories around suffrage and progressive era activism. And it's really, I think, contributed to a certain level of invisibility, especially about what working class women, immigrant women, and women of color as a whole were up to in this period, some of whom called themselves feminists, some of whom did not, but were decidedly engaged in kind of an emancipatory politics with their whole communities and were very mindful of what that meant for women in particular. So part of what I'm doing with my work is trying to make visible this world of transnational, multilingual, radical feminism that was very much a part of the turn of the century, and that historians have been documenting for several decades, but that still has yet to make it really into mainstream understandings of feminism. And to answer your question more directly, that Italian women were very aware of what the Italian women I'm writing about, the kind of working class immigrant women in the U.S., were very aware of what they called bourgeois feminisms. They read them, they heard about them, they attended talks, they read the pamphlets, they were engaging with that political culture, but they saw themselves as very distinct. You know, they did not seek inclusion in the nation state. They sought to abolish the nation state. So, you know, for the women I'm writing about, right, who were anarchists and socialists, these were where you find feminism in Italian immigrant communities, was in these radical movements. And their feminism was, again, they used the word feminism, but they often used the word emancipation, because what they sought was not to join power, but to completely disrupt it and to completely reimagine the world. You know, they critiqued the state, they critiqued the church, they critiqued capital, and that was the change they were interested in.
That sounds like a very anarchist position. Did these women believe, as some women believed back then, that if females ruled the world, things would be different?
No, they absolutely did not believe that, because so many of the women that, you know, they were very critical of bourgeois feminisms, and they did not see middle class or elite women as their allies in any sense, especially among the first generation. In fact, I discovered that in these two newspapers from Paterson, New Jersey, in the early 20th century, this outpouring of women's writing, it didn't make it into the anarchist press very frequently because they were very male, kind of dominated spaces. But these newspapers that emerged in Paterson that were edited by a man whose partner, they were edited by Pedro Esteve, who is a Spanish anarchist and journalist and printer, very well known in Spanish kind of language immigrant communities among Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Spaniards, as well as among Italians. And his partner was Maria Roda, who was an Italian immigrant textile worker from the north of Italy, actually. And she was one of the first founders of the women's groups within the anarchist subculture in Paterson. And I think my suspicion is that because of their partnership, and since he was editor at the time and she was clearly devoted to women's emancipation, that they sought that women's writing made it into the newspaper. And what you see in their writing is a real critique of elite women. You know, they see these women as the employing class. You know, there's this beautiful essay by one woman who says, you know, these women who's when their skirts touch ours as we pass in the street, you know, treat us as if we're dirty and disgusting, and yet we're the ones who are producing all the silk and all the lavish fabrics that fill their homes and that adorn them. And so this real sense of frustration with women with whom they were not allied. So they absolutely did not believe that if women ruled the world, things would all be okay. They were committed to a revolution that absolutely included men in multiple ways.
Did these Italian immigrant women like Maria Roda, did they rely for their activism on the established trade union movement?
At first, they did not, because the established trade union movement was formed primarily by and for skilled white workers. So they relied on the revolutionary working class movement that took shape in the early 20th century through the mutual aid societies, and then became a much more kind of larger national force through the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was established in 1905. That was the first, I could say, more formalized structure, if you could even call it that. But it was a more formalized movement that they imagined themselves as a part of. But the formal trade union movement, Italian women really didn't join that movement until the 1930s and 40s, till the Great Depression, until the mass-based worker movements of that period really transformed the trade union movement and brought many more women into that movement and, you know, many more people of color, and completely transformed the union culture as a result.
How about the labor strikes of the early 1900s? How prominent and important were the contributions of Italian immigrant women to those strikes, to that militancy?
Yeah, I think that they begin to see that if they want to organize in their fields, which in the Northeast were primarily garment work and textile work, that the best route for that, especially once the IWW was so targeted by the U.S. government in the first Red Scare of World War I, the IWW is really crushed by the U.S. federal government that seeks to undermine its efforts in every imaginable way because it's becoming more and more popular and powerful. And so offices are being raided, people are being rounded up and detained and thrown into prison. And so the IWW really struggles by the 1920s. And throughout the 19-teens as well, the garment unions and the textile unions have some presence and are beginning to shift and change and admit their lowest wage workers into their unions out of necessity. So the International Ladies Garment Workers, for example, that union, which was really rooted in Jewish radical culture at the early 20th century, by the 19-teens, they realized that they have to begin to mobilize Italians if they want to remain effective, because Italians are just pouring into the industry and the lowest sectors. And so the 1909 strike that most people who've studied women's history hear about, the uprising of 20,000 That's a strike that's primarily Jewish women. Italian women are the strike breakers in that strike. And as a result, folks take a real close look at what needs to happen for the future. So by the 1913 strike, Italian women are much more present. They are now organizers. They're bringing other Italian women into the union. And so 1919 is another big strike for that union. And that brings tens of thousands of Italian women and men into the union. Of course, all unions suffer as a result of corporate capitalist approaches to trying to deal with unions, so that union membership tended to decline in the 20s and also as a result of the Red Scare. But by the 30s, you know, these unions emerge again so powerfully as a result of the Great Depression. So, but the foundations for Italian women's participation in the 30s are definitely laid earlier. And a lot of the organizers who were key to the 1913 and 1919 strikes come directly out of the radical subculture. They are the ones who are in the anarchist and socialist mutual aid societies, who have been organizing for, you know, for much of their lives. And they become the key folks who help to mobilize those unions in the 19-teens.
That's the voice of Jennifer Guglielmo. She teaches history at Smith College, author of Living the Revolution. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Jennifer. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jennifer Guglielmo is Associate Professor of History at Smith College. She is co-editor of the volume Are Italians White? How Race is Made in America. And we are talking about her book, Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. So, Jennifer, to what extent did these women in these radical organizations, these organizations formed by themselves, to what extent did they try to call attention to what we now might call the 1% and the degree to which elites lived off the labor of the common worker?
That was the heart of what they were attempting to do, is to make visible the incredibly difficult and demeaning and dehumanizing conditions under which they worked, and the ways in which they were producing and other working class people were producing enormous wealth that they never had access to. You know, you can imagine, these are folks who went into the factory 12 hours a day, often 6 or 7 days a week. They were working in conditions that were, you know, poorly lit, badly ventilated, extremely dangerous. There weren't a lot of labor codes that governed their working conditions, especially in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, and certainly at the end of the 19th century. And they were very low paid, and employers were always trying to find ways to pay them less and less and less. So they had a sense of themselves as part of this kind of army of working people who had to, in order to topple this emerging, as they saw it, kind of industrial capitalist world, had to unite and had to come together. You know, and the industrial workers of the world, their famous motto was, you know, workers of the world unite, the sense that that was the only way that they could even begin to challenge the wealth of capital and its power, was by coming together with one another and calling it out, really calling it out for what it was, you know, a system of profit that required their subjugation.
And one of these radical immigrant women wrote, "Why does the pleasure of some have to create misery for many?" What about nationalism. To what extent did these women, these anarchists, single out nationalism as the problem?
Nationalism was side by side with capitalism as a system of oppression that governed their lives. They believed that nationalism was created to preserve the power of capital, and argued that the boundaries were arbitrary when it came to people and the ways in which people needed to move through space organically, and that these boundaries were erected in order to produce profit, in order to justify the marginalized inclusion of some people, right? You can grant some people citizenship status and deny it others, and those who are denied citizenship status, you know, create a low-wage underclass that will produce even more profit. So they were very aware that nationalism was actually a tool of capitalism and was one of the primary ways that capital created a structure that enabled it to perpetuate itself, right? And this was, of course, visible to everybody and continues to be visible to people when you look at who is occupying the positions of power in the nation, right? Who are the politicians? Who are the people who are successful in getting policies passed, right? They were the folks who were also the capitalists. So to them, they were absolutely intertwined.
And does this play into your argument, which you make very forcefully in the talk you gave at the North American Anarchist Studies Conference, that these women had a distinctly and deeply transnational focus?
Yes, their whole identity and their sense of themselves was very transnational, as it is for migrants today. You know, these are folks who were born in another land who, you know, if we think about it from the women's perspective, the men and their families migrated maybe for a decade before they too migrated. So there was time where the family was, you know, moving across national boundaries, and so their sense of themselves was transnational even before they ever left Italy because of how much migration shaped their communities. And then once they are migrating, they are working in settings that are with other migrants from all over the world. So their transnational sense only expands as they migrate themselves and meet people who themselves have transnational identities. And that formed, you know, the Workers of the World Unite was ultimately a transnational kind of imperative, right? The need for workers of the world to come together, to not locate themselves within national boundaries, but to transcend them in order to really challenge global capitalism.
You write that most of the women you are studying, were inspired by an anarcho-syndicalist named Errico Malatesta. What was the thrust of his critique?
Errico Malatesta was an anarchist who, like most anarchists at this time, you know, had this critique of capitalism and nationalism and of the church and of religion, that these are intertwined systems of power that had to be collectively kind of toppled and challenged and critiqued. He also believed in the mobilization of workers through industrial unions. Although many anarchists were very skeptical about unions, that they could also become bureaucratic and hierarchical, and of course, you know, they were right in that some anarchists like Malatesta still believed that some level of organization was critical in order for revolution to occur, that people had to come together in small groups, and that's where the mutual aid societies were really key here, is that kind of formal organization could serve a purpose. And so he spoke to that strand of anarchism that appealed to many Italians that were, of course, organizing in the United States in industrial unions at the time.
Yeah, and in fact, syndicalism refers to the importance of organizations within the workplace, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
How about education? How about the way in which girls were brought up, maybe to think of themselves in certain ways? What critique of the educational system did these women develop and publicize?
Well, the educational system was pretty non-existent for Southern Italians in Italy and in the United States. Italians did not value formal education overall. And I'm speaking for those who were not anarchists and socialists. You know, this was, for Southern Italians, these are peasant, working class people who didn't have access to formal education. You know, formal education was the preserve really of the elite in Italy at the turn of the century. So what education meant to them was it was usually apprenticeships. That was the form of education that they knew. And it was, you know, sending your daughter to the local seamstress to learn how to sew, or sending your son to the local barber to learn how to cut hair, or, you know, sending your children off to, you know, to learn how to build things. And, you know, they were trying to prepare their children for the economies, both local and international. And so one of the things that the political culture, the radical political culture, gives to this generation of immigrants is a way to go beyond that, to begin to learn how to read. You know, the vast majority of Italian immigrants were illiterate. So for many, joining the Mutual Aid Society and then becoming active in an anarchist or a socialist circle meant maybe being able to learn how to read and attending lectures and, you know, learning about political philosophies and ideologies from all around the world. It was a very invigorating scene. And I think that's why so many people were drawn to it, was that it spoke to them. It spoke to their hearts. It spoke to their struggles. But it also enabled them to become more than just low-wage workers. They could become creative, intellectual people who participated in the production of knowledge. And that was exciting to a lot of folks. And as a result of that, they began to really reflect on what have we internalized? What have we learned? What is the education? How have we been socialized? And how is that absolutely critical to revolution, that we think through the ways we've internalized dominant notions that produce our own subjugation? So, for example, the women who wrote these essays in the newspapers that I mentioned talked often about how to encourage women, especially as mothers, to educate their children to think critically and to not just blindly accept their authority and therefore anybody else's authority. You know, they would say, you know, rather than just demand something from your child, you know, engage them in a conversation, ask them to think about why it is they're approaching something this way or that way. And in that way, they sought to produce a next generation that wasn't just kind of willing to be submissive and blindly follow along, but that had a sense of individuality and a sense of their own inner authority.
My guest is Jennifer Guglielmo. She's Associate Professor of History at Smith College, and we are talking about her book, Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. Again, we have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write that for these Italian immigrant women radicals, pleasure was seen as primary. In what sense?
Yeah, I began to discover in looking at their writing and the different ways they were active how important pleasure was to them. And it took many different forms. It was the pleasure of a day of leisure and being able to be among like-minded people and enjoy a play or listen to music and inspire your imagination with dreams of an alternative reality, one that wasn't as oppressive and dehumanizing as the ones in which they found themselves each and every day. It was, you know, the chance to get dressed up and put on a fabulous outfit and go to a picnic and meet up with others and joke around and have a good time and tell stories. And that, you know, for folks, as for all human beings, right, pleasure is what keeps us, you know, the earth is not an easy place to live. The world is enormously challenging, right? It's a painful, it can be very painful, very toxic, extremely disappointing and depressing. And especially for people who have very little access to power, right? And so I became really interested, as many other folks are who study marginalized communities, in the ways people survive and how they find ways to keep their spirits intact and how they find ways to go on and also find ways to resist and create alternative worlds and build alternative possibilities. That pleasure is not only personal but collective. Joy, I guess, is another word one could use. That joy is so deeply significant to the human spirit, and finding ways to to create spaces for that is absolutely critical, I think, in the history of all marginalized people.
Emma Goldman, the anarchist firebrand, is famous for, among other things, her advocacy of free love. Did they advocate that?
They did. Anarchists absolutely advocated for free love. They believed that love, like the heart, should be unhindered, that it shouldn't be constrained by religion and the church or by the state. They wanted to create a context in which love could flow more readily between people and between communities. And so most people, I think, limit their understanding of free love to that they believe they could have multiple partners. But that was, you know, the anarchists debated everything. You know, there was no fully agreed upon set of principles except maybe the basic core principles. But they, you know, they talked endlessly about what free love meant. And to some, it meant the ability to have multiple partners. To some, it meant that you could form a relationship with someone, a monogamous relationship, and then when that ceased to be a healthy place for the both of you, and when you, you know, it was no longer teaching you or giving you what you felt was in your best interest, that you would then move on and form another relationship. They wanted to create a world in which people could kind of organically come together and move apart without there being stigma or, you know, grave social consequences.
So we've been talking a lot about history, Jennifer, some important history, some important women and groupings and important ideas. But I have to ask you, what's the significance of the history you've been sharing with us to the, you know, to the current political moment, to the struggles that radicals are involved in today?
Well, I hope that this history, I'm a big believer in history just as sustenance and as a set of, as storytelling, as helping us to survive and also nourishing our imaginations and our spirits as we move through extremely difficult times, that we can turn to the past and the stories of our ancestors as a way of finding a way forward. And, you know, this generation of Italian radicals, because their descendants would really focus their energies on becoming seen as white and begin mobilizing as whites. This history, you know, because it, what it meant to become American really required that they disparage and disregard and erase and hide these histories of radicalism, that I feel, you know, the U.S. history as a whole is kind of built upon a particular narrative that erases these more radical histories. And so bringing them to the surface helps us to think about how, just to be critical of how history has been a tool of the U.S. nation as it has imagined itself in particular ways, and also how these alternative histories and radical histories, working class histories, the ways that they suggest and teach us about how people survived, how they came together, the ways that they built community, how they got their ideas out there, how they were able to, you know, just the kinds of ideas that they circulated, the kinds of visions that they had. I think the heart of the lesson for me, what they've taught me, is how much revolution is both inner and outer, and how much revolution is not something you wait for that will someday happen, that to embrace the present moment as the moment of revolution, that each and every moment presents itself with a chance to create another world and to create another reality. And I think especially now, at a time when we're witnessing how much race and class and other systems of oppression have only grown in some ways and become more deeply entrenched in our world, that to have these stories of the ways people critique them, I think is we need them desperately. I hope that they can be really nourishing for the next generation.
We've been talking a lot about women. Let's talk about a woman, because there are a lot of forceful and really inspiring and charismatic personalities among the figures that you studied. So you referred earlier to Maria Rhoda. She immigrated to New Jersey from Italy in 1893 when she was 15 years old. Tell us about kind of her personality, her sense of politics, and how active she was in trying to rile people up.
Maria Rhoda was an interesting character on so many levels. You know, she became politicized as a child. She worked in the Lake Como area, northern Italy, as a textile worker. Like many of that generation, she went into textile work very young in order to help support her family. Families needed the labor of, you know, the wages of everybody often. So kids went into wage labor very young. And she became involved in labor strikes as a teenager, as a young teenager. She was imprisoned too for a period. So she became very well known in that local milieu for her, you know, for her audaciousness. You know, she's in her trial when she was sentenced, she apparently kind of gave the judge a piece of her mind, took it as an opportunity to really speak out against the working conditions in her community. So when she migrated to Paterson, New Jersey with her family. There was a group of textile workers from that same region who were there really ready to accept her and to give her another platform there. So she really hit the ground running in the New York metro area and became a celebrated speaker pretty quickly. And Emma Goldman recalls seeing her speak in her memoir and just how she was, you know, electrified the crowd and had a very charismatic presence. And
For Emma Goldman to say something like that about somebody else is interesting.
Yes, exactly.
That says a lot, yeah.
Exactly. And that Emma Goldman kind of fashioned herself as her mentor. You know, she thought, I'm going to take this young woman under my wing and help mentor her. So that too, right? That Emma was enamored. You really see in her memoir that she was very much enamored with Maria Rota.
Jennifer Guglielmo, Guglielmo. Author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945, co-editor with Salvatore Salerno of the volume Are Italians White? How Race is Made in America, and associate professor of history at Smith College. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for joining us.
Sure. Thank you so much, CS, for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time.